Blog Talk Radio.
Matrix, 923, I'll give you a corrected address, but you have a fire in a one-story ordinary, looks like it's about 40 by 120, 125. Get your traffic control, squad 5, squad 5. England to 273, 273. England Battalion, 18, 18 Battalion. With a 273, 273.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. Tonight, this is Fire Service Court Radio with John Murphy as your host, retired deputy fire chief and attorney at law out here in Washington State. And with me tonight, we have Chip Comstock, who is an attorney in Ohio and also a fire chief. Ordinarily, we would have joining us are Brad Pinsky, and hopefully Brad's mother is listening to us tonight. Brad is a fire chief in Manlius and an attorney in New York. And finally, Kurt Verone, who's retired, but active as an attorney in Rhode Island. And I shouldn't say that he's actually retired. I think he works for another organization in his retirement from his original job in Providence. So tonight we just have is the Chip and John show. And we're going to have an interesting discussion about fit for duty. It's come up a couple of times as people are asked to go for a fit-for-duty evaluation. We're going to get deeper into that here in a couple of minutes. And we hope to have Dr. Beth Murphy on as a guest on our show because she does fit-for-duty psychological exams. And I thought it would be nice to have her kind of lend her expertise into what she looks for and what the expectations are. And if I can switch a hat, I'm also a medical provider as a physician's assistant. I've been doing this for over 40 years as a PA, and I do fit for duty evaluations as well, so I can lend some of the medical aspects of what I would be wanting to look for if somebody was sent to me for a fit for duty. But a couple of business items. First of all, Penwell, actually Clarion Fire and Rescue Group, has purchased Penwell and I think the rights to fire engineering and this show. And so I guess we would welcome Clarion Fire and Rescue Group to us and them to we to them. Hopefully this is a long-term, highly profitable and productive adventure for this particular group. And I cannot go on any further without mentioning FDIC 2019 in Indianapolis on April 7th through the 13th. There are also scholarships that are afforded by Honeywell this year again, and we thank Honeywell for sponsoring those. But you have to apply. So if you're in our listening audience of the thousands of people that are out there, and if you want to go to FDIC, you should apply for a chance to win a scholarship to go to this awesome conference where you'll hear not only the four attorneys talking about legal issues affecting the fire service, but hundreds of others in a lecture or a hands-on training episodes for that entire week. This year, again, iWomen's is co-locating in Indianapolis for their conference, and our conference is April 7th to the 9th, and we would encourage people to register for that conference as well. There's going to be several great speakers in that conference as well, and just roll right over into FDIC for the remainder of the week for lectures. I just want to take a minute to thank all of the wildland firefighters that are out doing, you know, God's work in suppressing fire, protecting lives and property. Unfortunately, we've had several firefighters perish as a result of these sort of highly dangerous wildland fires. We certainly here in Washington State have been affected, not quite to the extent as we see in California, but there's still enough fire to go around for everybody. And so if you're on the wildland team, be careful. And for my friends in Hawaii, if you're not already been hit by a hurricane, there's going to be a big hurricane coming. So be safe and bunker down. So without further ado, and I hope Chip's still on board. We're gonna.
I am, John. The only comment I have on your introduction is you said if you're interested or want to go to FDIC, and I think the proper statement is, well, we should assume that everybody wants to go to FDIC. the place to be. I think the only question is if you want somebody else to pay for it, then then there's scholarships available, because we, like I said, we know everybody wants to go. It's just a matter of on whose dime are you going to travel.
Right. And it's certainly not going to be on Chip's or my dime this year again. But yeah,
that's right.
Thank you. I stand corrected and clarified. I feel a lot better as a result of it. So, the scenario, and this is the scenario, and some of you may have gone through this already, and it's probably one of the most terrifying things, you know, for you and your career. So the scenario that we're going to be working from tonight is, you know, Captain Smith has been off work for 6 weeks or so seeking treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder related to his military service. Although the condition was debilitating at first, he indicates that he feels much better and is able to return to work full time. The employer, fire department, is insisting that he take a fitness for duty exam before he can go back in. So the question is this legal? That's the first question. And then in his narrative and scenario, it seems like the employer is assuming that I can't be trusted to handle myself just because I have a mental condition. So the first question, I guess, for my listening audience and my fellow attorney comrade, is this legal?
Well, and John, before you continue on, one of the things just in your scenario, you know, we talked about post-traumatic stress disorder, which is, you know, more and more diagnosed, but, you know, there's all sorts of mental disorders and that I may not be even referring it to properly. Again, that's where Beth will correct me, just as I know she does you on a regular basis. But seriously, you know, I mean, we have firefighters that have depression, are bipolar, have anxiety, have, you know, a whole host of mental condition that may or may not affect their functioning on a occasional basis. It may be daily, but it may be just occasional. And again, when we have these periods when a firefighter is off, the same scenario presents itself. So, you know, again, we're going through the issue where, and I think that you set it up, is, you know, we're at the return to work point, and the employer is questioning, you know, or is questioning whether the firefighter is able to return, and insisting on the examination. So, I think then the question you asked is it legal for the employer to require that type of test?
Yes, it is the question.
So
there's deadly sirens.
Well, the first thing I'm going to say, and this is for our listeners, this is that John and Chip were covering our ass, which says that you need to ask your local legal counsel, because one thing that I've always said is, unlike doing ventilation or, you know, a left-handed search, or we're going to pump the XYZ fire engine and learn, you know, hydraulics, where there's some consistency across state lines, with the law, every state is different. So, you know, perhaps, you know, my hesitancy to answer that question was based a little bit on the fact that, well, may depend on the state you're in as to the very specifics. But, you know, as we usually do, we can talk about generalities. And it also, I should say that my answer may depend on a couple of factors. In the scenario you presented, we're dealing with a career firefighter, but there may be, you know, some differences between the career service on the issue and on a volunteer service. and the volunteer, whether it's a public entity or a private entity. So a lot of different factors that come in, but again, we can talk in terms of generalities, and then my generality answer would be yes. It is legal.
I like that. I like that answer because that's what the answer is I have on my crib sheet here. It certainly is. It is legal. I think the employer can do certain things as long as they're for the right reason, and we'll talk about what those are in a minute or two. But if it's a legitimate request for fit for duty because of the psychological issues that we talked about on the front end, or a medical issue, returning to work after surgery, or one of my favorite cases is a cardiac stint that was put in for a firefighter that had a cardiac arrest on the job, and the sort of the return to work scenarios that they had to struggle through, that he had to struggle through in order to come back to work. So yes, the employer has the right to demand or request or require a fit for duty, but it has to be for certain reasons. So the question is, and we're going to kind of come around again on the legality part of it, because there's a couple other constitutional issues that possibly Chip would want to talk about. But what is a fit for duty evaluation? So if your chief says, Chip, we're gonna send you for a fit for duty because you've been off for 3 months coming back from a surgery. What does a fit for duty evaluation entail? What is it?
Well, in my mind, it's determining. It's a determination. And again, we'll talk about how that's done. And that's your specialty. But in my mind, that fit for duty test is a determination as to whether or not the firefighter is capable of performing his or her specific job. And I think it's important that we're looking at his or her specific job. So that's an evaluation. It's a simplistic version, but that's my sort of version of it.
Right. And I think you're right on. So when they talk about the specificity of what your job is, I think the term that has been used is the essential elements of the job. So can you do your job, the essential elements of the job on the medical aspect of it? So can you lift and carry and run and climb, and do you have good cardiovascular capacity and muscular strength and those sorts of things? The psychological one, hopefully Dr. Murphy gets on. She can talk about the nuances of a psychological exam because it's not quite so evident. I mean, you didn't break your leg, but you broke your psyche, or you had some other mental meltdown that caused the requirement for a fit for duty. But when I do my fit for duty evaluations on firefighters and other people that are required to go to work, I need to know what the essential elements of the job are in order to measure whether you have the capacity to do that in a testing scenario. And it's sort of multifaceted. So When I have my medical hat on, I'm looking at, cardiovascular capacity. So we do, a PFT, pulmonary function test. We may put you on the treadmill for a stress treadmill. Some docs do immersion, body fat index, things like that, if you're fit for duty because you may be obese. And so there's a lot of different testing parameters that the medical community can use, but your doctor or the doctor that's getting requested to do the fit for duty needs to know exactly what your job is, and the purpose is pretty much to evaluate your ability to return to work. So and many times your ability to work is maybe in question. Again, we talked about some psychological issues. We talked about some physical limitations. We talked about surgical recovery, knees and backs, and hearts, and those sorts of things. Some of our firefighters, more so now than we've noticed in the past, only because I think it's been reported more, is cancers. Can you return to work after successful cancer therapy? So, you know, one of the things, Chip, also is how about if your chief didn't like you, and I know that you are the chief, but how about if you didn't like a person in your organization? Can you send them for duty to try to eliminate them from the organization?
Don't most chiefs dislike at least one person in their organization?
Well, at least.
You know, but my line is same clowns, different circus. And I said, you know, every fire department has that one guy who drives the chief crazy. And maybe it's people trying to figure out who that is. But likewise, as you say, you know, I'm sure the firefighters say that every chief has a part of him that they don't trust for whatever reason. And you know, the problem here, I think, is in a perfect world, all chiefs would do the right thing, and we wouldn't have a problem. That wouldn't even be an issue. But we've all seen it. I mean, there's some outstanding fire chiefs around who just don't let anything bother them, are constantly looking out for everybody. But unfortunately, every other profession, there's a few duds out there, and the chiefs that are really vindictive, who don't like their authority questioned, or you know, they're insecure and they have issues. Well, you know, whatever the underlying cause, again, that goes probably to our psych issues. But as a result, firefighters truly believe, and probably in some instances with good reason, that the chief will use the examination as a tool to restrict the firefighters' ability to return to work, or will eliminate it. And you know, the groups will look and be suspicious of the process. And so, you know, as part of that, you know, you have to have a decent process in place to address the return to work issues. These are legitimate issues that need to be addressed. But again, you know, it's trying to think of a word. It's a reality. I mean, the issue is, you know, we have these competing concerns of the purposes to make sure that the person's capable and it will be safely returned to work, and we're looking out for that employee. We're looking out for the firefighters. We're looking out for the department and the public. But at the same time, we do have to address concerns that of the employees that the test might be punitive.
Exactly. And so the return to work, we've chatted about job performance issues. So sometimes people have poor job performance. You can see a declination in their performance over time, where the firefighter came in, it was, you know, an outstanding, hard charging individual. And then all of a sudden you're seeing over time a declination in, you know, in their performance, you know, and they don't show up for work. They're taking extended sick time. They're, you know, malingering, I guess, for the lack of a better term. And so sometimes organizations who are observing these sort of behaviors will, you know, hopefully they will anyway, without just going through a termination process, is to put that person who's affected through some sort of a return to work or a fit for duty evaluation. The other evaluation that we do as a fit for duty is for new hires. So post-offer physical examinations. The only caveat I have for the employer is, if you're going to hire somebody, you need to have essentially a letter, a conditional offer of employment, in order to perform some of these invasive evaluations, such as a medical, physical, or a psychological examination. And that's just what I would classify as a baseline evaluation to see, you know, if you can physically do the job, and if psychologically you're prepared, you know, for some of the issues that you will see during your tenure as a firefighter.
So I just want to stop you real quick, because even though I know we're talking about primarily return to work, you did mention the post-offer physical exam for jobs. I recently came across the fire department that policy was, you know, you do the examination, and then we determine whether we want to make an offer or not. And, you know, I thought most departments had gotten away from that process where, you know, the physical first, then the offer, and as opposed to offer, then physical exam. And for anybody who's listening, just so they understand, the reason we do the reverse, offer the examination or offer the job and then can make it conditional upon the successful passage of an examination, is that we avoid the ADA, the American with Disability Act, implications. Because if you make the job contingent upon, or if you make the person take an exam first and they don't get the job, the inference is going to be that you discriminated against them, that the potential employee, based upon some protected class or some disability. And so by offering the job and then making a contingent upon the passage of exam, you don't have to worry about the rejection of any potential candidate. So just wanted to mention that. So
again, right. And I think that's a good point. Trying to conditional offer first.
Yep.
Because then what happens is that the potential candidate firefighter is essentially consenting to the exam without, you know, infringing on their rights of, their ability to get the job by what you said, evaluating first, finding out the guy's a dud and not hire him. And I think that may raise a legal challenge that it was a pretext for not hiring.
Correct.
So you kind of segued into the ADA. So Americans with Disabilities Act. So if I say, for an example, I was injured on the job, I broke my leg. I have a rod in my femur stabilizing the leg, and my knee is sort of got screwed up in the accident, and I can't pass the fit for duty examination. Does the employer – I guess the question is, am I classified disabled? Maybe, right? And then does the employer have to take me back under some other conditions, like make a reasonable accommodation that will accommodate my, you know, locked knee and rod in my thigh and all that sort of stuff? Is there a requirement for that under ADA?
Yeah, the first question is going to be, does the fire department, is it subject to ADA? I think in most instances, the answer is going to be yes. So moving on, next question, and again, we're going to big generalities, is, you know, do you have a disability? And is the department taking action against that or putting you in a position where, you know, they need to make reasonable accommodations because you're a disability and they don't? And, you know, the best example that I have seen, and there's a number of them out there that I'm aware of, is firefighters who have prosthetics. You know, there are firefighters who have, you know, don't have a prosthetic leg, or I've seen arm, you know, in the old days it'd be, well, hey, you know, they can't do the job. Well, you know, a lot of times they absolutely can do the job, and we're getting into situations where we are not recognizing that we're taking action against a person based upon what might be perceived as a disability or isn't disability. And again, you have to look at how the law is. The one thing that, again, we get into it always is, you know, what is a reasonable accommodation for the firefighter based on, you know, their condition that they may have suffered, and we're evaluating as part of the return to duty. Is again, can you make a reasonable accommodation? And the one that I've not seen a judge yet order a fire department or employer to make reasonable accommodations. And again, this is in a firefighting context, and that's a person in a wheelchair. You know, we have the issue of, you know, how are they going to get on the engine? How are they going to get off the engine? How would they do a search? What would be their job? Again, we're talking about firefighters. Maybe a much different situation if our person in our wheelchair was an inspector. A fire inspector had no fire duties. You know, is that a job? Or, you know, in a large city where you have a firefighter who is injured and has a wheelchair, and maybe there is a job that could be accommodated depending on, again, it's part of the job, again, anywhere from a dispatch or maybe in a rehab unit or something else. So, again, it's going to be on a case-by-case, department-by-department basis. But certainly, the American with Disabilities Act will come into play and will, as I think you and I discussed, may limit what the employer can do as they're doing the return-to-work evaluations.
So just kind of branching off on the reasonable accommodation, because I've had some people say, well, the department has to have me come back to work. They have to make a reasonable accommodation for me under these certain circumstances. That's not necessarily true, is it?
I think it's going to depend on, again, what is the disability? Is it a disability? Oh, they got to do this and this. Well, it may not qualify as a disability, whatever that condition might be.
Right, so, and there's certain parameters under the ADA.
Yeah.
Which we won't go into because they're numerous in detail, but, you know, if there's been a life change, you know, the ability for you to take care of yourself, there's several different evaluation components of determining under ADA if you're disabled or not. And, again, it's incumbent on the department to do an evaluation, see if they're required to do a reasonable accommodation. And if they are and they can do it, I think the department has an obligation to the employee, firefighter, to allow that reasonable accommodation to occur. So the question is, and again, the issue of people that may have prosthetics, and we're seeing a number of military veterans being asked to join the fire service. They apply and they pass the test. Some have limb replacements in the lower legs. Some have arms and hands. My favorite story is the police officer in Port Angeles, Washington, that has a genetic amputation from mid forearm down to his no hand. And so he applied to the police academy, and they rejected him right off the get-go because he was observed to be disabled because he only had one hand. And so a good friend of mine who's an attorney and I wrote a letter to the director and said, look, he may be able to pass the essential elements of the job, and he's already got a job offer up in Port Angeles. I'm not sure whether he's still there or not. But he passed the academy. He could do everything any of the other police officer candidates can do. And so he passed the academy. And so the question was, can he reload his pistol? And he can do it. He figured out a way to accommodate the missing limb, and he was very successful. And so just looking at somebody doesn't necessarily mean they're unable to do the job or disabled. It takes that sort of extra testing on the part of the organization. So can the candidate or the returning firefighter perform the essential functions of the job and, continue to be successful?
You know, that's an interesting scenario, John, that it doesn't happen often. We've talked about it in the context previously of sort of a sexual harassment discrimination setting where there'd be female firefighters that would go through the academy pass. They would then go to the employer. The employer would terminate them, saying they couldn't do the job. And we'd look and say, wait a second, they just passed the academy. How can you possibly say that? Because they've done everything they could. And what we've seen in some instances, it was an academy problem where the firefighter or firefighters, regardless of sex, were just passed on and graduated because maybe they needed to keep the numbers up, whatever it is, and they shouldn't have ever passed. And now, you know, a person gets hired based upon the representation of the academy and causes a problem when they're terminated because they really can't do a job. Well, a little bit different scenario. If you have a firefighter who has a disability, is able to go through the academy, successfully completes it, and doesn't get hired, as you said, because it's some obvious issue, that's a real risk for a department. It's a little bit different than the scenario we've sort of focused on, which is a person is able to do the job, then has an issue, physical or mental, after they've been employed. And so now we're trying to evaluate whether they can do the job that they previously did. And, you know, sort of the interruption, the event takes place during the employment as opposed to prior to the employment. And again, I think that'd be an interesting issue, the one you raised with the police department. I think a fire department who was confronted with a person who had already completed training and applied for a job and didn't hire him could potentially face, assuming the disability was obvious, could potentially face a claim for ADA or discrimination. But I'm getting off a tangent, or I'm going off on a tangent again. So we'll get
no,
we'll
you're
get
not.
Back
you're
to our,
you're right on point. We're on point. So, you know, under the, we kind of take the full circle back to the legal side. You know, to legally require an employee to submit to a fit for duty eval, the employer has to have a reasonable belief based on objective evidence. So objective evidence is that you're eyeballing it, not subjective where you heard or you feel or you thought or somebody told you. You have to have objective evidence that the employee's ability to perform their essential elements or essential job functions is impaired by a medical condition, or the employee poses a direct threat to safety. So sometimes people that have a psychological issue may be of risk to themselves or others. Others that have a physical limitation may cause a risk to themselves or others. And so if you have objective standards and objective observations, then I think you're fairly safe in and again, I fairly say if the employer or the lawyers always hedge their bets, that's the depends theory. And so, you know, you do have the ability to ensure safety, not only for your firefighter, but for your firefighters and other employees in the organization. There's a case. Go ahead, Chip.
I was just going to say there's kind of two different scenarios that we've been talking about, and we've branched into new ones. I want to go back for a second on our original. You know, I think the easy case is where the person says, hey, I broke my ankle, broke my shoulder, broke my arm. I'm going to be off work for 6 weeks. Well, you know that they have that medical condition, or I've had a heart attack and I'm having surgery, or I'm going to be off for cancer treatments. And so there's a period of, you know, a week, 2 weeks, a month that they're off, you know, it's off, and now they're coming back. And that's a fairly objective standard where you look and say, they've told you, I mean, hey, I've needed to take time off for medical reasons, and now I want to return. The new scenario that we kind of went into was, I think the person has an issue, and that's where, you know, maybe they've been off an extra couple of days and people say, hey, the reason is because he's got an alcohol or drug problem, or he's, you know, fighting his personal demons, and that's why he hasn't been around. And now your concern is to whether this person has the capability of returning to work or should be at work. And I've had fire chiefs call me and say, hey, here's the deal. This person didn't show up for work today. He called in, and I've been told that he went to the hospital or was admitted to the hospital or checked into the hospital himself, and that or herself. And you know, word gets back through the fire service that the guy was having mental health issues and goes to the hospital voluntarily for treatment, has been off, you know, a week or, you know, whether it's vacation or whatever, and now people are saying, hey, the guy's coming back. And now you don't have, you know, it's not like the employee came to you and said, I'm off because I have this medical issue, or I've got, you know, now the question is, well, how do you handle that in terms of the right to test? This is where you get into more of that objective versus subjective, and what evidence do you have? This is where it gets really tricky, is when you don't have that really clear information sitting right in front of you. You're now getting a lot of information from other sources that raises these concerns. And again, it's not a clear return to work deal. It's more of a, do you have the right to order tests in those situations?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I think, and then they talk about, and we've talked about this, is the disability aspect of it. So the exam can't be used as a way to assess whether the employee has a disability or the severity of medical condition. But again, it may be utilized to obtain disability-related information designed to help assess whether the employee can safely and properly perform his or her job responsibilities. And in my experience, I've had two or three people come in over the last number of years on a fit for duty, and you look at them, and it just on the surface it looks like they're able to perform, but when you actually have them do the job, they're unable to perform because of maybe surgical implants, maybe because they lost a thumb or fingers, or they can't grasp or grip, which is an important component of what we do. So then that creates this sort of, the report back to the department that, this person has a disability, they're unable to perform based on, an injury incurred on the work. And so what does the department do? So we circle back to the Americans with Disabilities component. Do you need to make reasonable accommodations? And that, so that, that entire argument about, return to work, either fully or a modified duty. And I like your suggestion sometimes. And I like the wheelchair. Sometimes I don't like the wheelchair, but I like the wheelchair scenario in that, maybe the firefighter had a debilitating or paralyzing event at work, broke his back, severed his spinal cord, is a wheelchair bound. What else can the firefighter do? So I think, the examples that you gave of, fire inspector, or even that has maybe some limitations, a dispatcher, could work as an office assistant or work in the training division and, organizing the training division. So I think there's a lot of opportunity. The question is what is the employer willing to do in order to accommodate, these sort of disabilities? The other thing, too, is we have, I think, the return to work under extended illnesses. We're seeing, and I think cancer would more than likely classify as an extended illness. So, cancer treatment just doesn't occur overnight. I mean, those are long-term therapeutic events. And much of the time, if you're on chemotherapy or radiation therapy, you're not doing well afterwards. It's pretty debilitating. And so, when you do have somebody that comes back from a long-term disability, I know in our organization, we retrained them, right? Is that what you do in your organization?
Well, I'll be honest. We've had limited knock on wood experience with firefighter cancer treatments and so forth. Now we had them. Yes, we try to do as much accommodations to the extent we can. Volunteer department's a little bit different than the career department, because the career department, you're there. If you're coming back, the employer is expected, obviously, to pay the employee, and the employee is supposed to perform some service. And, the question is, first of all, can they do that job? Are they able to? Like you said, there may be a retraining period. In a volunteer service, it's going to be the same way, but I think there's a little bit more, there can be more flexibility. Maybe there should be flexibility everywhere, but a lot of times the economic realities with a career department is they just can't work as much or have the ability, they don't have the same ability to just let the employee go at his or her own pace. So, but I think that we run into that in all departments. And as you said, the cancer seems to be rising. Fire Service is trying to do its best to limit it, but we're gonna have people, because of necessity, are gonna want to return to work, and you know, we're going to have to see how we work those issues out.
Yep. So there is a case in Washington State where a police officer suffered a head injury, taking time off for work. Several years later, began acting erratically, making sort of out of control statements. So there's enough activity, observable activity that went on that required the department to order a fit for duty test. And he challenged it. He challenged the ability of the organization to do so. This case went all the way up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and they held in favor of the employer that they have the right to do a fit for duty psychological for this guy with his head injury because of the officer's volatile behavior, stress and danger inherent in his job. And the employer questioned the officer's ability to do his job based on observable behavior. So the court allowed the exam to occur. And then it did not constitute a disability discrimination under the ADA because his claim was that he was disabled because of his head injury. And the court says, no, you're still on the job. You're not disabled. The employer is requiring you to have a fit for duty psychological exam. So, but there are other cases that, you know, the court says, and I don't have one as an example, and maybe the one in Ohio that we put on the end of our talking points here tonight may have some weight on whether the department has the obligation to do certain fit-for-duty tests and that sort of stuff. So I think early on, and way early on, not tonight, but in other shows, we talk about policy and guidelines. And so do you think it's a good practice, Chip, to make sure that your organization has a policy or some other guideline for, you know, what are the observable factors? And then, you know, where do we send our employees for fit for duty? And, you know, are the results confidential and can we take action on the results? Is a policy a good thing to have?
Well, as lawyers, as you just said, you're always advocating that the departments have policies. And I think, you know, I'm going to go back and start off with, I think there ought to be a policy that addresses how you handle examinations pre-employment. We've already talked about that. There ought to be a policy that says, you know, we're gonna have the person qualified to perform the job he or she is scheduled to do. You said we're gonna want to make sure the person can sufficiently perform the essential job function. And so we want to have that process in place. We want to have, you know, whatever standards by which we're going to use to evaluate whether the person can do that job or not. So that's the first process, I guess. The second then is the second policy ought to address the return from work. And again, that's what our lecture is. But again, it doesn't make sense to me to have a return to work policy unless you have a physical exam policy to begin with. You know, we're not going to hire you and not do an exam or not have a process and then say, oh, but if you get injured on the job, now we're going to test you. So I think there ought to be a first exam. And then, you know, I'm a big advocate on annual exams and have exams, as we've already indicated, test for cancer and so forth. And those are very helpful, too, to have the annual examination because a lot of times you can catch problems before they go further. You know, you get them in their infancy stages. And so you don't run into a large medical issue later on because you're going to treat it up front, and it may save you some other issues. But, again, if an employee has been off for a period of time, if the employee has raised issues, objective issues that, you know, question whether or not they can adequately perform the job, then I think there has to be a policy in place. The more it's nice to have a policy that talks about if you've been off for so long or if you've been under a physician's treatment and aren't able to perform the functions before you're able to return to work. You know, if a department has been asked to, you've been off for a period of time, I think requiring whether it's a doctor's examination and the doctor's the person's own doctor wants to perform the exam, you know, some volunteer department say, hey, we can't be paying for all these doctors. Well, then have somebody certify that the person's capable to return to work. You know, even if it's the person's own treating doctor, they can sign a letter saying, you know, I understand here's the functions of being a firefighter. I've examined this person. I'm familiar with their medical history. Based upon my exam, the medical history, and my, you know, expert opinion, this person is able to perform the essential functions of a job. And then I always throw a little thing in, and I understand that the fire department will be relying upon my opinion. So kind of put the doctor a little bit under the understanding that his opinion is important. We just don't want him signing off. So that, you know, there's ways to do those exams, and departments should talk about, you know, how they're going to function, how they're going to perform them, either at the pre-employment stage or in the return to work. And then, you know, the mental health issue, it doesn't come up often compared to the physical exam, and I think that's because it's just not either diagnosed or it's not as well known that people may be suffering. You know, I've said before that, you know, everybody in the fire service has a mental health issue. It's just a matter of what it is and to what degree it affects them, because, again, the average person, the normal person, doesn't run into burning buildings and doesn't do the things that firefighters do. So I think there's, you know, something there to begin with that puts us in this world. So, you know, the issue is how are you going to handle that within the department when the issue surfaces? And, of course, it's always better to have plans in advance than be trying to scramble and do something that you haven't thought about in advance. And now, because if you do and you do something different, you're liable to somebody make claims that, you know, again, you're discriminating against them or you're treating that person differently. One quick note I do want to make, that with the career firefighters, one thing is most collective bargaining agreements that I have seen address return to work issues. And, you know, if a firefighter's been off so long, if they've done this or if they've done that, they do a pretty good job of addressing the process and procedure of how an examination is going to take place, or how a medical examination is going to occur. They don't do as well a job as it relates to mental health issues. They definitely don't do a good job as it relates to mental health, like we've talked about, the, you know, drug and alcohol, reasonable suspicion, and you know, there we have send somebody for testing because everybody understands that that's necessary to prevent the firefighter from hurting himself or others. But you know, mental illness, depending on what's going on, can have that same negative impact. So again, I think it's worth sitting down with in advance, whether it's with a union, between an employer and a union, or whether it's, you know, within a volunteer department, part-time department, saying, okay, if we have a person who's demonstrating that he or she may be suffering from some sort of issue, probably, you know, mental health issue, then, you know, how are we going to handle it? So, John, it's been, you know, just rambled on about, you know, should you have a policy? The answer is yes.
Well, thank you for cutting to the chase. So Dr. Beth Murphy is actually on, so we'll have her talk in a couple of minutes about psychological fit for duties. Good evening, Dr. Murphy. How are you?
Good evening. I'm well, thank you. Hi, Chip.
Yeah, yep.
Well, there. I won't ask you to determine whether or not I'm well, because you and I both know the answer to that question.
I cannot divulge that information publicly.
Thank you for that.
But just before we get to Dr. Murphy talking about psychological fit for duty, just a couple of other things, kind of parlaying off what Chip talked about as a policy. I think the you know, when you use your local physician, my personal physician probably doesn't have a clue what I do for work. And so a couple of things that may help them is, send over the job analysis that your department hopefully has put together, outlining what the responsibilities of your firefighters are. And the other document, which has kind of been around for a long time, is the NFPA 1582 standards, which to a lay person, to anybody, it's hard to read and it's kind of confusing. Remember, if you're going to use the NFPA standard, I think it's a couple of things. One, you probably, and I'm kind of mixed on this, you want to adopt some of the aspects of the 1582 standard, but, you know, then you wonder if you adopt the 1582 standard, you're essentially held to that particular standard. So they have candidate firefighters, and then they have incumbent firefighters, then they have a section in there on return to work, if somebody has a disability and doing, those sort of fit-for-duty evaluations. So the document, I think, is valuable. I think it should be utilized by some of the departments when you're taking a look at sending a person over for a fit-for-duty, whether the parameters and the dimensions that are in the 1582 standard can be utilized by your evaluating medical practitioner. And I think the person that's going to go for the fit for duty, the firefighter, has to understand, we're using this particular standard, or we're using a job analysis that we did for what you do currently. So everybody is pretty much on the same page. And then I do like the comment about the labor agreements have been fairly detailed in returning to work. Some that I've worked with have been less than detailed, leaves it open to the interpretation of management and the physician. And we've always tried to err on the side of the firefighter that we're sending out for fit for duty, evaluation.
John, let me ask you a question. When you say you err on the side of the firefighter, meaning that when in doubt, you say the person is able to return, or when in doubt, you say, look, I'm going to protect you and not let you return to work? I'm not sure when you say you err on that side, which side you're erring on.
I actually err on both sides because I am an attorney and I can do that. I think a lot of it has to do with first of all, you have to look at sometimes you'll have a practitioner that's not as competent, I hate to say this, as you would like them. And I wouldn't send anybody to that person. Second of all, we may get somebody coming back to work that we know is totally qualified to do the job, but for some evaluatory process, the practitioner has applied, it disqualifies that individual from coming back to work. So, for an example, you have an individual that has, what I had. I had, the bad knee and the rod in my femur. But then the physician finds that I have high cholesterol and hypertension. So does that disqualify me from coming back to work? Not necessarily if I'm being treated. But the physician may say, well, you can't come back to work until you get your blood pressure and cholesterol under control. And I think those are pretty good health provisions. And yes, I want to make sure my blood pressure is under control and my cholesterol is down. But does that preclude me from coming back to work? That's the question. So the other part is, just to kind of go off on a tangent, how about if the firefighter doesn't agree with the return to work, like you cannot come back to work? Does the firefighter have the right to go out for a second evaluation?
Well, that
from a different provider?
I wasn't sure you were going to go that direction, and that's where I was thinking I would like to discuss that issue, because that does come up. And we talked some time ago about firefighters concerned about the vindictive fire chief or a process of abuse. So, those firefighters that have those suspicions usually want to address that. Well, what happens when the fire chief says, the doctor says, because, by the way, the fire chief should never say that the person's not fit, because the fire chief doesn't have the medical qualifications. Not usually. I mean, I actually know a couple fire chiefs. Like, we have fire chief lawyers. I know a couple fire chief physicians. But they're 99.9% the chief's not qualified. So we have the doctor who says that the employee is not fit to return to duty, and the firefighter says, "Oh, I want to go out and get my own opinion." And so, that I think has to be a decision that's addressed again in advance. Is that something that the fire department is willing to go through that process? Is that doctor willing to take responsibility for that employee if the employee gets hurt? There's a number of issues that employers raise. What if everybody's willing? Sometimes what I've seen done is if the employee gets a doctor who says employee fit, the employer's doctor says he is not, they will then choose a third doctor, and the third doctor's opinion is final. They give all the reports to that doctor. So sometimes the doctors will perform exams. Sometimes they'll just review the records and see what the opinions are of the docs. My thought is, if we're really trying to search for the truth, and whether it's in a law practice or here we are talking about fire issues, I always think that we should be searching for the truth and not trying to jade it. Either the person's qualified or they're not. And so if we're going to use a third doctor, then the best result is that doctor should perform an exam, should review all the records, should make an independent judgment. But again, I've had clients who have said, I don't want to take all that time. I don't want to have to spend that money. We are going to choose a qualified doctor to begin with, and if he thinks the person's not qualified, that's it. But I think that it's easier, if particularly in a collective bargaining setting, if before we get to these scenarios, we've already come to an agreement and everybody understands that's going to be the process. Again, volunteer departments can do the same thing, have it in place. But I personally don't have a problem with a second opinion. But, again, that's up to the department.
And that's good. And I want to get Dr. Murphy in on this because her particular specialty of psychology is a little bit not as crystal clear as a fractured leg or a missing limb or those sorts of things. So you probably have heard what we have been talking about, and it deals with fit for duty, return to work sort of stuff. And so as our resident psychologist for the fire lawyers and fire engineering in general, what is your opinion, Dr. Murphy, on the things that we pontificated about?
Well, so that's really broad because I haven't heard everything you've talked about. So are there a specific question?
Well, let's start out from this point of view. Okay, so the direction, the compass is pointing in when somebody is sends you a firefighter for a fit for duty, or some other public safety officer sends you a fit for duty, what do you want to see from the employer?
Well, so the employer needs to have a very clear reason for why they're sending the individual for a fit for duty. So it may be that the employer acknowledged that they had a problem and they took a leave because they were having mental health issues, and so they took leave, they sought treatment, and then now they want to go back to work. So it would be reasonable then for the employer then to say, okay, then we would like for you to have a fit for duty evaluation. And this process is one that I see most often in in working with police departments. So this is their process. This is part of their policy. For the fire service, it's not that clear cut, and a lot of it has to do with their understanding and what their policy is. So if the employer initiates, like, so if the employee has not voluntarily gone out for treatment, and the employer believes that the employee presents a risk, then they need to have clear evidence as to why that is, and that will support the request for fit for duty. So, you know, like, and I think it's a lot like for drug testing. So most departments have, like a zero tolerance, or they have, like, some very, very low limit for alcohol. They are generally not tested unless there's been an accident. So the accident in wrecking a vehicle, a department vehicle, is usually the catalyst for that person going and having to have a drug test. So it would be something similar for the psychological exam.
Okay. So our scenario that we talked about early, before you got on, just so we could start our discussion, was the one of the captains in the department has been off work for 6 weeks or so, seeking treatment for PTSD related to his military service. And then although the condition was debilitating at first, he says that he feels better and is fully able to return to work. His employer is insisting that he take a fit-for-duty exam before he can go back. So the question is it legal, which, you know, Chip and I probably beat that horse to death. And we say the short answer is yes. But if you get this firefighter coming into your office with this direction from the department, says, you know, he's claiming to have PTSD, he's being in counseling, we're trying to determine whether he can come back to work. What do you do? What's your process in these sorts of scenarios, and in real life too? I know that you've faced this in real time. So,
yeah. Well, so because I'm not an attorney and I am a psychologist, if somebody comes to me and they say, the department wants me to have a fit for duty before I can return to work, and they're in my office making an appointment, or they've called and made an appointment, then they're basically they're agreeing to do it. So it's like, from the legal aspect and the decision of whether or not the fit for duty is warranted or not warranted, if they show up in my office and they're saying I need to have a fit for duty, then my biggest concern at that point is one, that, you know, I can do it, and then I can do it ethically, but also, like, who's my client? Who's going to be paying? Because one is, that allows me to get paid. Two, it also matters on how the report is released and who has the right to the information. So if the department has ordered it and the employee shows up and says, my department has ordered this fit for duty before I can return to work, then I also need to be in contact with the department, the chief or whoever they designated as the point person, because then I need to know, what it is their concerns are, and I need to understand the purpose of the fit for duty, and then I need to understand the tasks that fall under their duty, so that I can answer the questions for them. So I have to have specific questions. I have to know who my client is. And so if the department orders it and the department pays for it, then the employee is not my client. the department would be. And so then I would notify the employee of their rights to confidentiality, which essentially they have none. So everything they say to me would get turned over to the department. And I shouldn't say everything. It's like everything that is relative to answering the question would be turned over to the person that is directing the fit for duty. And I let the client know this before we even start. So they always have a choice to follow through with it or not. But a lot of times when people are sent for a fit for duty, the implication is that if they do not go through with it, that they will not be returning to work and essentially they will not have a job. If the client comes on their own and they are going to be paying, then they are my client. And so no information is released without the express consent of the client. That make sense?
Yes, maintaining the confidentiality, which is very important. The other question is that when I do a medical return to work or fit for duty, I can do it in a day, pretty much.
Yeah.
So, you know, everything's all set up. We do the exam. We do the testing. It's either thumbs up or thumbs down. We write the report. It's out.
Yeah.
The psychological fit for duty is a little bit more complicated. Can you kind of talk about that a little bit?
So the psychological fit for duty can be very complicated or it can be really simple. So how long it takes really depends on the complexity and the process of writing, analyzing, and integrating all the information. So a really straightforward, simple one where, like, the individual hasn't had, let's just say that they struggled with depression and maybe some PTSD symptoms. And they've been a good performer at work, and so, there's not a lot of discipline issues. There haven't been any other psychological assessments. It's so basically straightforward. So it's like they were struggling, they got treatment, and they're wanting to go back to work. And so basically the fit for duty in that instance is kind of like without discipline issues and stuff like that, it's kind of like almost like the department is kind of covering their butt. Like they want to make sure that there is a mental health professional that can sign off on, how that person is functioning at that moment. Now, if they were in treatment, it is possible that the treating therapist or psychologist could answer specifically the questions related to, can this person perform their duties or the tasks of their duties without restriction? And if there is a restriction, is it related to the mental health disorder and what specific restrictions are there? Or what can they do and what can't they do, basically. So it can be really straightforward. And in that sense, it could be it takes, I know people view it in less time, but for me, I usually spend at least an hour interviewing. And then sometimes 2 hours if it becomes more complicated. And then the assessments themselves can take time. So, I'm giving them the personality assessment inventory, which takes takes about 40 minutes to fill out, or the MNPI 2 RF, or the MNPI 2, and that takes MNPI 2 RF is shorter, and that can be done in about an hour. And that's only one test. And so then there's a series of other tests. And so all told, it could be easily another 2 hours or 3 hours of assessments, and then writing it up. So most psychologists would have some sort of template, which just basically has like the basic information that is pretty much true for everybody, like the disclaimer about confidentiality. So the section that spells out who the client is and how the information can be used and who has a right to that information. And if the individual does not have the right to confidentiality as far as returning, providing information to the department, then that needs to be explained, and that's all in the assessment write-up. And then there's demographic information, and then background information is included as far as it's relative to answering the question and towards speaking about the risk and resiliency factors. So the risk of developing mental illness or worsening, or resilience factors that kind of counter that. And then a review of any other reports. So if they were in treatment, it would include a review and a summary. So it would, the report would include a summary of the treatment. So the intake, at the very least, it needs to involve intake, and then the discharge. Including, you know, the discharge planning. And then it may also involve, like, a summary of the progress myth. So what was done and how much progress was made and how invested were they in the process and stuff like that. And then the assessment. There's always going to be included in that a description of the test and what it's for, and then there'll be a format in how that information is included, and then a maybe a summary of that, and then a discussion of how it all fits together, and then a recommendation. So the write-up is pretty involved. A lot of it can be like there can be a template which can really shorten it, which means you're just basically plugging in the new information and then writing a summary or a discussion, and then making the recommendations, which generally are not fit for duty, fit for duty with restrictions, or actually it's not fit for duty. Not fit for duty due to psychological issues, and then fit for duty with restrictions, and then fit for duty. So there are possibilities, and then some psychologists will just say, you know, they'll do whatever their write-up is, and then they'll say, you know, fit for duty or not fit for duty, but they don't explain what went into that decision, while others will say, you know, it includes this, 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 and this. So they could address point by point the job task and the psychological impact on each one of those things. So, it could be really short or it could be long. So it just kind of depends. That was a really long answer. Yeah.
I think it was a good answer. And I know that Chip has a question.
Oh, sure.
No,
My one thought or comment, you know, as you go through that about the confidentiality is you hear a lot of people talking, employees talking about the medical exams, whether it's on a mental health or not. You sort of addressed, you know, who's the client. And people are talking about the fact that if you're working for the employer or the examining physician is working for the employer, that the records, the information is protected by HIPAA. I don't think it is.
So it is, and it is, and it isn't. So, and this is something that is addressed in, like I said, is that there's a piece in like the write-up and part of my evaluation where I make sure that the client knows that what they tell me may be disclosed to their employer. And that's providing the employer is the client. Now, the employee may tell me something in the course of my evaluation that is actually not relevant to answering the question. So that doesn't get written in. Only the information that is relevant to answering the question is included in the report. And then the other thing is that information then, and it says on my report, who has a right to access this information? If it is stated to me that only the department chief is going to have access to this information, then that is on my report. And if the chief shares it with anybody else, then they have violated the confidentiality and HIPAA. So it's like the report goes to only the people who are named specifically. And if it gets passed around to anybody else, then they've violated that.
Well, see, I'm gonna argue with you. Again, it comes down to the state, because you are not performing the examination for the purposes of diagnosis or treatment of a patient. You're doing it for employment purposes.
Right.
So I don't know if HIPAA is relevant at all. And I would make the argument, if you were in Ohio and you sent your report to a chief or to a person at the department as it relates to an employee, I think that's a public record, unless there's a basis for exclusion. Now, it may be that because it otherwise contains some confidential medical information, you could argue that there is some, you know, medical information contained within it, and you could make an argument. But I don't know that it's just all that easy. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, if you're hired by the client and you're hired by the employee, and he or she is going to you and saying, I want a determination as to whether I'm fit for duty, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if depending on the results, you can then share them with the employer. And you're really doing that evaluation for the employee. To me, that's really diagnosis and care and treatment, and probably protected by federal law and HIPAA. But I think when you're doing it for an employer and it's for some other purpose, the lines aren't as clear. And we can try to follow some guidelines, like you've indicated. Hey, I'm sending this to you. It's confidential. If you share it, that's your problem. You know, you violated confidentiality. But I think people have to understand that there are many times where medical records have been ruled not to be confidential medical records because they're not for diagnosis, care, and treatment.
In psychology, in order to determine fitness or not fitness, we're talking about whether it's also determining whether it's due to, so one question, so it's a two-part question. Is it, are they fit for duty? And is it, if not, then is it related to a psychological illness? And so it does have information in it that is related to past treatment, continuing current treatment, to their diagnosis and how that diagnosis impacts their work. The reports state on them that it is to be treated like any other medical record.
Yeah, and again, if I was the employer, I'd want to keep it confidential, and I would argue with the employee to keep it confidential. But my view is I don't know that it's that simple. I understand everything you're saying. I would hate to have somebody think that their records are always safe, because depending on the court and the circumstances, somebody might make an argument that they're not. I agree, but there's going to be documents within the document that you can say, this is, you know, you're taking other records and incorporating those records into your report. Clearly those other records are, but, you know, and so the argument would be, well, redact that. I just want to know what your conclusions are. And the conclusions are not necessary for employment purposes. Again, if you're working for the employer. So,
then all you would get then is like really no information, and somebody who may or may not be, good at what they do saying, I mean, you redact a good portion of it. So the stuff that would support the fit for duty or not fit for duty, is all based on like psychological tests that are protected, and they're very specific. There are very specific written guidelines about the release of that information, and then any other in treatment, which, you know, that's a diagnosis and treatment. So, you know, if you take all that out, then you've got somebody who may or may not be a good judge saying fit for duty or not fit for duty. And then, you know, so you can't talk about, like, this person is fit for duty without, I don't know, I guess you could, but, you know, like, how did they get there? And they got there because they have a mental illness.
Yeah.
However, when you take a look at filing medical information as opposed to employment information, the requirement, as far as I know, is that you need to keep two separate and distinct files for the same employee. One is a disclosable employment record, application, testing, you know, things that weren't medical, but, you know, the physical abilities test and all that other stuff, maybe some testing, scoring sheets on performance, those sorts of things. And then the second file is the medical file, which is separate completely from the personnel file. And so the medical file would contain HIPAA-protected information, the physical exam, blood work, you know, things that are important to the health and wellness of the firefighter. Those aren't a disclosable sort of document based merely on a public records request or a FOIA request. Those are records that, if requested, then the employee should or must or shall, depends, give their permission for the record to be released. That's my understanding. Is that not your understanding, Chip?
No, I think that's a fair and general I think that's a general premise, and I think
right.
I agree wholeheartedly. There must be two separate files. The question that I've raised is, when Dr. Beth says this person is qualified to return to work or is qualified not to return to work, based upon my exam, what part of that, if any, is discoverable in a public records or FOIA request? And I'm not sure that I can state conclusively that it's protected. And I think it's going to depend on the circumstance and what's contained within that record. I'm going to request your medical file.
I'm going to request your medical file.
If you're
and see how you argue that case.
Course, you know, it's going to take weeks to copy.
It's probably a microfiche that's been so old, right?
stone tablet.
Yeah.
Yes.
Stone.
Well, so the there's, you know, so you're also, you're talking about, like, what is dictated by, like, you know, state laws and federal laws, but there's also, you know, like, these, the psychological exams can, they're only administered by a psychologist. So then you have the code of ethics that psychologists are held to. And so from that perspective, like, their take is that you follow the higher standards, whether it's the APA code of ethics or the state or federal law. And they, I was just looking because I know, like, I just read it and it was pretty clearly spelled out. And so these are not new rules. And they are clearly stated.
So let's move back to our conversation about the testing process that you do, the evaluations that are done, the reports that's written. This is, you know, it takes time. So I don't think employers need to expect this thing, you know, within 24 or 48 hours. It may be a week or 10 days in order for you to thoroughly complete your assessment. And so So one of the things you talked about, Dr. Murphy, was that sometimes there's the return to work with conditions.
Yeah.
And so the conditions can be therapy, medication, counseling, and so is the individual qualified to do the job, the essential functions of the job under these sort of conditions that they have to comply with in order to stay at work, for an example, like show up for therapy or take their medications. And again, the medication maybe can't inhibit their ability to do their job. So I guess the question is, do you send people back like that, and is that acceptable for the employer if the employer is your client?
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting. So I think that this gets into an area where if there's not a clear cut policy and there's not a clear understanding of the job and the expectations of the employer, then it can be difficult. So it's like I can make a recommendation, and that recommendation may not be feasible for the department. But it's like it's not my place to determine the feasibility of what I recommend. And so there may be a recommendation that the person can return to work, but they should continue with therapy. So, you know, I'm not the person that's going to make that happen. So the employer has to decide, do we take this person back and check in with them that they're still doing therapy? So, and I don't know how that works for the department. I may recommend that the person can return to work, but they continue therapy and they should work in a modified capacity. So, like, maybe they were a lieutenant, but the nature of their mental illness affects their judgment, cognitive ability, and there's enough evidence to suggest that it might still be impacted, but it's improved. So the recommendation may be they could go to work but not be placed in charge of other crews or incidents or whatever. So, you know, if there's modified duty available, then it would be beneficial for them to have modified duty. And I think that this is kind of a new area for the fire service. It's not clearly spelled out. So I can make the recommendation that there needs to be some modification or that they can do these duties, but they would struggle with these other duties. And it's more like they would likely struggle because I wouldn't necessarily be able to say, yes, definitively they'll struggle. The evidence supports that there could be a struggle. So then the department needs to decide, is this what we want to do? When I look at recommending that they return to work and I recommend some sort of modification, I try to make that decision based on the evidence that is provided to me, but also on the current research. You know, because there's no book, there's no guideline for assessing firefighters for fit for duty. Now, there is for the police, so the IACP has a guideline that they publish that talks about the specifics behind fit for duty, but there's no equivalent for the fire service. You know, a lot of people are looking at the IACP guidelines and incorporating that stuff in with the fire fit for duty. So, it's imperfect, and ultimately it ends up, you know, what can the department accommodate? Which I imagine you talked about that. Like, do they have to accommodate? So if I say they can return to work, but they can't be in a leadership role, if they don't have light duty that would allow that, then, you know, do they have to create it, or, you know, what happens then?
Oh, good points. So we've been, and unfortunately, you've been on for a while. So I think that we're at 90 minutes. That's probably one of the longest shows that the attorneys have ever done, only because we're talking to you, Dr. Murphy, on psychological issues, and God only knows that Chip and I are psycho half the time. So, Chip, do you have any other questions, any comments?
I think, you know, John, just to reiterate what we usually talk about in all of our shows is that it's better to try to anticipate problems before they develop and have a policy or procedure in place, hopefully in writing, as to how you're going to address your physical examinations pre-employment or, you know, at your initial time. And as we've discussed all the others, the return to work, you know, continuing exams, et cetera, and have a process in place to deal with when an examination comes back for rejection for a person who's already been employed there. That needs to be addressed because, again, we want the employee to return to work in a functional capacity. And I think if the people take the time, if employers, employees together work on it, take time, you can avoid a lot of litigation down the road because of misinterpretations of what we should be doing rather than have it spelled out. So, again, I urge people to give some thought to these things before you find yourself knee-deep in mud.
Good. Dr. Murphy.
Yeah, so I think, like, one thing I want to add is that I think, you know, like, psychologists and when people who, other people who think they might understand the assessments that might be involved in, like, pre-hire employment and fit for duty, or, you know, something like psychodiagnostic or, you know, whatever the case for these psychological evaluations, you know, there's the assessments used are generally thought of as, you know, like self-report, which are considered to be subjective, and they, you know, it's a snapshot in time. And then there are like the personality assessments, and then a bunch of other assessments that are considered to be objective assessments. And I think the important thing to know is that putting all these assessments together, it requires the psychologist to basically form an opinion. And so even when basing their opinion on objective assessment, there is still subjectivity that goes into it, because they're formulating their opinion based on their understanding of the question, and then the issues that are presented and how the results of the assessment feed into that. So if you are dealing with psychologists that really don't understand the fire service, then you could end up with an opinion that could keep someone out who really would be, it would be a benefit to them and the employer to be back at work. So it's important to know that your knowledge of the background and how the how that informs how you look at what the assessment says. So you need to have context. So that context is important, and it what's objective is not always objective, I guess. I'm stumbling over how to say that. But basically, it's like, use caution. Just because somebody says that this is an objective report doesn't mean it is. So people write their biases in it, and they interpret the results, and they put it together in a way that can make their case one way or the other. It's very rarely clear-cut.
Very rarely clear cut. That's, I think, a good statement. Yeah. So thank you, Dr. Murphy and Chip, for coming on tonight. This is kind of an interesting discussion as it deals with the, sort of the legal aspect of fit for duty, which is really not an exact science, although we like to make it that way. And with the increased number of issues affecting firefighters with depression, suicide, PTSD, other sorts of things, it's not an exact science. So I think there needs to be a lot of pre-discussion and pre-planning, as Chip alluded to, is that we need to think about the unthinkable that may occur to our firefighters and how we can mitigate and prevent a lot of that sort of stuff. And being proactive certainly is an important component of what we do as leaders and as firefighters in our profession. I'd like to give a plug for Dr. Murphy's Firefighter Behavioral Health Program or show. It's on almost every month for the rest of the year. And just tune in to her. She's on Thursdays for her show, and talks about all things psychological. And she'll be presenting at FDIC this year. And remember, that time is April 7th through the 13th, 2019. As we talked in our opening comments, because everyone wants to go to the big show. But those of you who can't afford to go, there are scholarships that are being offered by Honeywell again this year. for about, 20 people, Chip, do you think? I don't remember the exact number.
Well, I was going to say, the person who's applying only needs to be the one. Only has to worry about
one. Only worry about one. And then just a reminder that iWomen's is co-locating with FDIC this year from the 7th to the 9th in Indianapolis with FDIC. And we, again, thank you for all that you do. We encourage you to be safe. For those of you who are struggling from mental illness, we ask that you reach out. And if you know somebody who is struggling with mental illness, you need to reach out to them. To offer a supporting hand and get them treated in treatment and going in the right direction. So without further ado, thank you all, and we'll be talking to you next month.